Welcome to BookSpeak on Indiana Public Radio, a chance for members of our audience to review a book on the air.
I'm Debbie Mix from Muncie, Indiana. When people ask me to name my favorite book, and they often do because I'm an English professor, they're always surprised by my answer, Moby Dick. That's right. Herman Melville's 1851 masterpiece is my favorite novel. Maybe that sounds like an English teacher read the classics kind of answer, but I'm not convinced. In fact, Moby Dick was a colossal failure when it was published, and it spent most of the 19th and early 20th centuries in obscurity, marketed as a boy's adventure book at best, but more often forgotten on the shelves. I admit, I didn't exactly come to the book by choice. I had to read it in graduate school, and maybe I never would have read it if I hadn't been required to do so. But, having read it, I've become a kind of cheerleader for it, foisting it on friends and students alike. Why am I so in love with the book? Why would I want to read about the defunct industry of whaling, the endless catalogs of whale species and flensing techniques? That answer's easy. Moby Dick is about everything. That's right, everything. It begins as a book about loneliness. Ishmael, its narrator, tells us he has decided to go to sea in order to prevent him from deliberately stepping into the street and methodically knocking people's hats off. We know his bravado is just a disguise for his isolation. He quickly meets and befriends Queequeg, a South Seas aborigine whom he describes as George Washington, cannibalistically developed. And this friendship forms one of the key threads of the novel, tracking the ideas of loyalty and sacrifice. Of course, the story doesn't belong only to Ishmael and Queequeg. Captain Ahab and his quest to hunt and kill the great white whale provides the driving force of the novel. Ahab has lost one of his legs to Moby Dick, and he attributes malicious and devious power to what others see as a dumb brute who acted only from blindest instinct. From this conflict come several of the novel's additional tangled threads, the natures of evil and good, the relationships between humans and nature, the desire for revenge. Around these men and that whale circle some of the most sympathetically and humorously drawn characters in American literature, noble Starbuck, playful Stubb, gentle Pip. We get to know these men as they sail the oceans searching for whales to kill in order to extract the valuable and primal commodities of oil and bone. The hunt for whales provides Ishmael, or more accurately Melville, plenty of opportunity to philosophize about the nature of humans, the elements of racism, the questions of democracy and power. What, after all, is Ishmael's consideration of a whale's body, if not a doubtful review of the pseudosciences of phrenology and physiognomy, of the ways 19th century minds invented and codified racial and ethnic differences? What is Ishmael's rumination on the whiteness of the whale, if not a profound struggle to understand the terrible myth of white superiority that underpinned so much of the violence and power we still know in the modern world? And what is the novel's meandering, sometimes obscure, narrative, if not Ishmael's attempt to delay the terrifying end to Ahab's quest? There's plenty to laugh at in the novel, too, and more than a little scientific knowledge to be gleaned. I've read the book at least a dozen times, no kidding, and it gets me every time, no kidding. I find myself returning to favorite passages again and again, because Melville's novel is ultimately a commentary on what America and Americans should be and do in the world. It is about love and loss, justice and sacrifice, madness and strength. And should I ever find myself on a whaling vessel faced with the awful task of stripping down a sperm whale's blubber in an effort to harvest its valuable oils, I'll know just what to do. This has been Debbie Mix for BookSpeak.
Hi, I'm Beth Dalton from Farmland. If you happen to watch The Tudors on Showtime, and if your mind ever makes it past the awesome costume design and the bodies in those costumes, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, OMG, you might have paused to question how a lust-addled, profligate king such as Henry VIII could have presided over the dawn of England's golden age. If you have, Hilary Mantel's 2010 Booker Prize-winning novel, Wolf Hall, offers one explanation: Thomas Cromwell. Cromwell, a low-born Englishman, had wit and opportunity enough to reach the highest levels of government in King Henry VIII's court. positions previously unobtainable to anyone without a pedigree. He was the prototype of a figure we recognize and honor today, the self-made man. This achievement has often been overshadowed in historical and literary accounts of his life by his involvement in the Boleyn affair and the ruthless suppression of Roman Catholic monasteries in England. However, as Mantell implies in her novel, he was one of the first modern statesmen in terms of fiscal pragmatism, and his policies helped establish England as a world power. Mantell's novel opens with a scene from Cromwell's childhood, a beating delivered by his drunken father. This is the beginning of Cromwell's education. He leaves home, travels the world, sees how folks make and lose money elsewhere, and eventually earns a place as the secretary and trusted confidant of Cardinal Wolsey in England. Mantell deftly shifts the focus from Henry and his cast of aristocrats to the machinations and struggles of Henry's ministers and advisors. While Henry's quest for an annulment from Catherine of Aragon sparks the action, his games of footsie with Boleyn are background to the power struggles fought by supporters of the Roman Catholic Church, such as Thomas More, and proponents of change, such as Thomas Cromwell. Eventually More, a Catholic who cannot bring himself to condone Henry's break from the Church, falls from power and returns to his home. Cromwell, on the other hand, makes way for the king's desires. Here again, Mantell turns convention on its head. Thomas More, the famed author of Utopia, is usually portrayed as the long-suffering minister who stands by his religious convictions. He is, incidentally, played by the beatific Jeremy Northam in The Tudors. However, in Mantell's Wolf Hall, he is portrayed through Cromwell's eyes as a cold-hearted papist who reluctantly takes St. Paul's better-to-marry-than-to-burn advice to heart. He brutalizes his family emotionally while exhorting the king to stay true to the faith. Mantell's Cromwell, on the other hand, is set up in opposition to this. While he is a pragmatic statesman, the Cromwell of Wolf Hall is written as a loving family man, one who grieves endlessly after a fever carries off most of his immediate family, and then informally adopts nephews and young servants to fill his echoing house. The Cromwell-More showdown is an ambitious undertaking in this carefully researched novel. Through this struggle, we see the complex issues confronting Europe during the first half of the 16th century. Rulers were beginning to chafe under Rome's yoke, and quite understandably wanted more control over the affairs in their own states. The separation of the secular world from that of the sacred, one that we take for granted today, was one only a few visionaries could conceive. Cromwell, a man freed of the social constraints and prejudices of the aristocracy, may have been one of these visionaries. But if the author's goal is to build a sympathetic case for Cromwell, it fails for me. Cromwell has little care for his countrymen and women. Despite his forward-thinking brilliance, it is hard to see him personally as anything other than an opportunist. Perhaps the best example of this is his decision to distance himself from his friend and patron Cardinal Wolsey once the latter falls from the king's favor. Later, and most notoriously, after Cromwell helps facilitate the king's marriage to Anne Boleyn, he coldly prunes her away when the king's fancy turns another direction. Both Cromwell and More are responsible for a sizable body count while in power, as Mantell points out. However, More, at least, stays true to a faith he openly acknowledges and is executed for refusing to take the oath connected to the king's act of succession, one that discredits his patron, the Pontiff of Rome. Regardless of one's feelings about the infallibility of the Pope or the correctness of the Church, it's hard not to admire More, whose allegiances seem unwavering and clear. Even so, the immediacy of the book is remarkable. The writing places the reader in the scene, so the effect of these historic and some not-so-historic moments is believable and compelling. The point of view is Cromwell's, that of the underdog and outsider, one widely appreciated by American audiences, and it goes a long way toward making what could be dusty, dry material present and alive. A warning, Mantell's use of pronouns, specifically he and him, can make for a bumpy read, as they usually, but not always, refer only to Cromwell's character. This bit of stylistic silliness makes the writing sweat more than it should and distracts the reader from a fine story. Overall, however, Mantell makes a credible case for reconsidering the importance and influence of Cromwell, whose economic vision and willingness to breach socially prescribed boundaries was ahead of his time. If, despite this, you still have trouble seeing eye to eye with Cromwell, do as I did and try to picture him as the brooding James Frame, who gives Cromwell a steamy turn as the king's devil during season 3 of The Tudors. I'm Beth Dalton for BookSpeak.
Support for BookSpeak comes from Toyota and Scion of Muncie and Ivy Tech Community College. Join us again next Wednesday at noon for another edition of BookSpeak.